Moss Cohen, welcome back to Radio Times. Seth Horowitz went deaf when he was just 3 years old because of a bad case of the chicken pox. Thankfully, his hearing returned even though his eardrums were scarred. He writes in his new book, "But Now I Hear Bats." Horowitz's book is The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. It's an exploration of this underappreciated sense that has played such an important role in evolution. It's about the complex interplay between sound and the brain and the difference between listening and hearing. It's also about everyday experiences like why a tune can get stuck in your head, why the sound of fingernails on a blackboard is so grating, how bullfrogs learn to hear, and why the sound of angry birds is universally frightening, and much, much more. Seth Horowitz is a neuroscientist and an assistant professor of research at Brown University and joins us on Radio Times. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Morning, Marty. Thank you for having me.
You're welcome. So did chickenpox change your hearing?
Yeah, it had long-term effects. I don't remember the incident, but my parents kept telling me that they were really hoping it would shut me up a little bit. What happened was I got a couple of the normal little red pustules on the eardrums, and they popped. And your eardrums are very important to the hearing pathway. So what happened was as they healed, they developed scar tissue, and so they thickened. And if you thicken a vibrating structure, it doesn't respond so well to the lower frequencies. So I have very, very good high-frequency hearing, but I'm not so good at picking up the bass. They roll around the houses. If I can hear the bass, it's too loud for the rest of the people.
But you said, but now I hear bats. What does that mean?
Well, bats are part of, they're relatively close relatives, but they're part of the sonic world that, for the most part, goes on beyond human hearing range. Echolocating bats, which are common on the northeast of the United States, usually make sounds ranging from 100 kilohertz, 100,000 hertz, down to about 20,000 hertz when they're echolocating. They build their three-dimensional world using sound the way we use it. We use our vision to build it. But this means that most of their calls are well outside the hearing range of anyone except the very youngest humans. Because very young children and people up to about the age of 18 can detect sound around 20 kilohertz. Mm. Until a few years ago, I could hear sounds up to about 24 kilohertz, but they weren't useful. It wasn't like I could get musical information out of it. It was just I could hear a scratching sound, so whenever the bats would fight in the other room, it was very annoying.
But you're also a musician as well, and is your wife?
My wife's a sound artist.
Or a sound artist.
So it's a very noisy household, and whenever we travel, we usually forget a camera, but we always have recording equipment.
But would you say that a hearing, sound, listening, that is an unappreciated sense?
Definitely, because one of the ironies of hearing is that we don't pay attention to sound. We use sound to drive our attention to other things so we can look at them. And one of the reasons that this is true is that hearing is much faster than vision. When you think about how most people get around the world, the sighted world, you know, you look at something, you identify it, you read a book, you look around your environment to get information. But vision is quite slow. It operates at a few times per second. So, and there's something good about this. You know, if you had vision that could see something popping up and identify it every 51,000th of a second, it would be very hard to make a movie because you'd look at a movie and see a bunch of still images just flashing before your eyes. But because it's relatively slow, we see a series of still images presented 10 times a second or faster as a moving image. Sound and the way that we hear is operating anywhere from 20 to 100 times faster than that. So sound is operating in the background. It gets into our brain and it gives us environmental information out of line of sight and in total darkness without worrying too much about the operating speed. We see at about the same rate that we consciously think, about one idea every half second or so. You're able to identify sounds and react to them in 50 milliseconds to 100 milliseconds. That's a millisecond is a thousandth of a second. So if you're walking down an alleyway and you're a little bit nervous about it because it's dark, you can't see, and suddenly you hear a sound, a loud sound somewhere around you, you will jump, you'll startle. you'll suddenly hunch up your shoulders and you'll start turning your head to look for the source of the sound. This is something that occurs in less than a tenth of a second, and it's because of a direct connection from your ears to your to all your spinal cord and your motors to get you to react much faster than you ever could visually.
In fact, you write, and I found this very helpful, that we should think of our hearing as an alarm system.
Exactly. It was, you know, very important, especially, you know, way back when, before we had houses and security systems and webcams. It was very useful to hear something sneaking up on you in the dark, especially if you couldn't hear it. And one of the things that most people don't realize is that your ability to localize where a sound is coming from, if you're paying attention to it, is almost the same resolution as it is visually. It's a couple of degrees. And people who have lost sight, I've talked to them about it, and they say that they can resolve where a sound is coming from just as well as I could. But it's something that you have to pay attention to, and most of us don't, because attention requires additional brain processing, additional energy expenditure, and it's hard to get people to actually listen to a sound when we've basically evolved to have it run in the background to alert us of problems.
I'm thinking of all those young parents with a little baby at home, and it's fascinating and I think revealing that when you hear a little cry or a little blurble in the middle of the night, if you're a parent, you wake up. Even in your sleep, we're hearing things that are very subtle sounds, especially if it comes from a baby.
Especially if it's your baby.
Especially if it's your baby, exactly.
That have shown that a mother, like a seal is one of the, sea lions rather, are one of the species that's been studied in a lot. You can have hundreds of seals. That sounds like a complete cacophony, but a mother seal can pick out the cry of her baby amidst this incredible noise. And this is true of humans as well. And one of the studies I've always wanted to see done, but never actually got to do myself, and haven't seen that anyone else has done, is the question of, does a woman's hearing change during pregnancy to make it more sensitive to specific cries of her child?
I would like to know the answer to that research as well. You touched on this earlier, but I want to make sure our listeners understand about the difference between listening and hearing. As you said, we live in a world awash with sounds, and I'm listening to you, so I've basically gotten rid of the sound in this almost soundproof room here. But nonetheless, it's interesting how when we don't pay attention, we don't hear.
Right. One of the things is that hearing is something that every living thing with a backbone does. And as I said, it's our alarm system. But listening requires the addition of attention. It's separate pathways in the brain. So that if you actually listen to music or listen to someone's speech very carefully, you're getting a very different kind of cognitive response to it. It's the difference between just putting on your headphones and going for a run and listening to whatever playlist you've come up with that probably has a strong beat and just sort of makes you lock your step to the rhythm, versus going to a live concert and attending to the music and letting it physically wash over you. It's a different way to use your brain, and it's something that we seem to do less and less as we're getting overwhelmed, especially with auditory information in our environment.
And you think we are getting overwhelmed?
I think so. I mean, a lot of people claim, oh, I'd like to find some place which is silent and sort of quiet. It's harder and harder to find that. I mean, when I was born in New York, and I've always been a city boy, and so to me, normal was, 65, 75 decibels, subway train going by. That's normal, and I didn't pay attention to it. When I first moved to Rhode Island, I moved to a rural area to go to Brown as a grad student years ago. All of a sudden, it was so quiet that the crickets would just stand out, and I took about a month before I was able to sleep without having some kind of noise going in the background.
It was so quiet it was noisy?
It wasn't that it was noisy. Yeah. It was that it was alerting. And neurons and parts of your brain actually respond to silence, and they don't necessarily respond in a good way. Neurons will suddenly start synchronizing, and neurons are the individual nerve cells, and there's 10 or 100 billion of them in your brain. And if there's suddenly a loss of signal, if you're suddenly not hearing something, a lot of them start synchronizing, waiting for the next signal. And sometimes this signal feeds into parts of your brain that are responsible for arousal and emotion, so that you're really getting nervous in sudden silence or unexpected silence just because there's supposed to be something happening. And you can find this as a cliche in a lot of movies where somebody's walking through the woods in some horror movie and one character turns to the other and says, "It's too quiet." Yes, it is. And then something jumps out at you, and that really is quiet.
Indeed. Your book covers a lot of territory, and I do want to play a bullfrog mating call. and this is an example of low-frequency sound, and I'm hoping that you can hear this because, as you said, you don't really hear low-frequency sound. But what should we be listening for as we listen to this bullfrog mating call?
Well, listen to how deep it is and yet how rich the sound is. And I'll tell, there's a really interesting series of lessons you can learn just by studying frogs, which most people go, "Frogs? Why are we caring about frogs?"
Well, let's listen and we'll find out. A very familiar sound, I think, for anyone that has lived or grown up in the country.
Right, that's the American bullfrog. Yep. They are not under threat of extinction. If anything, they're a pest because they're extremely successful predators. They're like little lions at their scale. And so they're everywhere throughout the U.S., and variants are around the world. And they're very dependent on sound for their social behavior and for breeding. What happens in the summer, you've all heard that sound, and sometimes you'll hear dozens of them all going off. It's like this wall of sound. And they're advertising. The female bullfrogs don't vocalize very much. They'll make a little sound if you pick them up, but mostly the males are positioning themselves around a pond or some other body of water, and making this loud sound, which is sort of like someone screaming, "Hey, baby," in a bar. And the females have to either approach the pond, attracted by the sound of this chorus, or go into the pond and swim to whoever is making the loudest sound, as long as it's the right species. Because loud sounds, if you think about it, if you've ever done any onstage singing or performing, having to sing loud or call loud for a long time requires a lot of energy. So the frog, someone who's calling loud and vigorously, means this is a very healthy animal who can afford to waste his time trying to get my attention. But what's interesting about the frogs is that they have rules. It's sort of like humans. We have very specific rules about our communication. We have a very advanced language, and if you speak to linguists, they think that human speech is special. But any vocalizing animal has a very specific set of rules to make sure that their communication is heard. So the frogs will actually answer each other across the pond, but if two male bullfrogs are near each other, they'll fight. Because it's a challenge. And the female will have to sit there and decide, okay, whoever wins this fight, that's who I'm going to go with. Of course, there are, as in humans, there are those sneaky males who sit there and going, okay, I'm not loud enough to be picked up, so I'm going to wait while these two are fighting it out. I'll go over to the female and sneak off with her.
Evolution in action. Seth Horowitz, we have to take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We're talking about hearing and sound and listening. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY, currently on view at PAFA, The Female Gaze, Women Artists Making Their World. Over 200 works from the Linda Lee Alter Collection of Art by Women, featuring modern and contemporary artists' depictions of themselves and their communities, a multiplicity of aesthetic viewpoints, working methods, and political perspectives. More information online at PAFA.org. The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY.
This week on This American Life, a music professor believes that he's found a way to kill microorganisms with sound waves, and he starts to wonder if they could destroy cancer cells.
No chemo, no radiation, no cutting. You walk in and they have a large bulb and they turn it on for 3 minutes, and inside of a month you're done.
He teams up with a real cancer researcher, a serious one, and gets unexpected results.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
A roller coaster stock market has many Americans pulling their money off Wall Street, and that worries economic gurus, including Bloomberg Businessweek contributor Robin Farzad.
A whole generation of investors is kind of bringing on heartbreak by acting the way it is now.
The danger of Generation Sell, next time on Tell Me More.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane. We're talking about the fact that sound is everywhere. Our ears are processing millions of noises all day long. And again, our guest is Seth Horowitz, author of a new book called The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You describe a percussionist, a woman named Evelyn Glennie, who I've actually interviewed, and she is a largely deaf percussionist, a world-class musician. How is she able to do what she's able to do? And it's really quite extraordinary.
It is amazing. I was really honored to be able to work with her. I'm working with a group called the Just Listen Project, which is going to create a 3D IMAX film about sound, and Evelyn is going to be the narrator for it. So it was wonderful that I was able to actually go and hear her. And we talked for a little while, but the most amazing thing to me was just watching her play. She was playing a concert marimba, which is basically a car-sized instrument. And watching her come out and play, what she would do, she came out barefoot. So she's picking up vibrations of this through the floor. She also was arranging the resonators, which are these tubes that sit underneath the strike plates of the marimba, so that the vibrations from that would come out and strike her shin. I also watched that when she was playing, when she was playing the marimba, she had her neck back, and she's picking up vibrations along the neck and the upper part of the chest, which is a very, very sensitive area. Also, when she was playing the snare drum, she was curled over the instrument, so she's using her entire body to pick up the vibrations that, for the most part, she couldn't hear. So she really helped redefine music for me in that it's not just something that comes in through your ears, but it's something that drives your perception throughout your whole body. And one of the fun things about it was that I was allowed to do some recording, and as I said, you know, I always show up with too much gear.
Right.
So I was able to set up my own little microphones, but I also used some specialized equipment called geophones. These are low-frequency microphones that are used to record earthquakes. So they only pick up very, very low frequencies, and from talking to Evelyn, I think that's the remaining range that she has after she went deaf at about 12. So what I was able to pick up was the difference between what we were hearing, listening to the sound in the room, versus the vibrations, which is what she was picking up, not through her ears, but through her body and through her skin. It was very much like going to a concert for the deaf, where your body becomes a receiver. And one of the things I was able to do is put in my book a little graph showing what the sounds look like when you use a specific tool. And you can almost see the percussion every time she'd strike a mallet against a key as a physical object, because it was very discreet. This is the source of the vibrations. She's still picking up and creating music, even though she is perceiving it differently than most people with normal hearing.
Makes you think.
Music is a universal.
Yes, but it also makes you think differently about what music is.
Exactly. I mean, music, there are so many different definitions of it that, I mean, one of the problems I had with was coming up with a definition for music. And this is a problem that scientists have with music, because we're supposed to work on operational definitions. How do you define music? I have at least 12 or 13 different good ones, but science has a lot of trouble with music because they use definitions ranging from an organization of tones in a specific order at a specific beat, which basically could be, you know, a car going down the street, to something extremely emotional, like describing the key of D minor as being full of womanly spleen, which was one of the early 18th century descriptions trying to scientifically describe musical keys and what they mean. It's an ongoing issue. There are some wonderful people working in music and neuroscience, but it's still an issue that's very hard for science to address.
Well, speaking of music and musicians, I do want to play Mozart's Sonata for Two Pianos in D Major. And there was a fair amount of interest in some science, the idea that there was this Mozart effect and it would help you have smarter children and, you know, take care of all of life's problems. It didn't necessarily turn out to be true, but let's listen to this piece of music, and then I'd love to have you, Seth, describe what it is that we're hearing and why it might be helpful, but maybe not in ways that were touted early on. Let's listen. That's just a little excerpt from Mozart's A Sonata for Two Pianos in D Major. So from, a scientific point of view, what are we hearing?
Well, what you're hearing is extremely harmonic sounds played at what would be considered a human scale. It's played on acoustic instruments so that nothing has been particularly distorted. Nothing is played beyond the range of normal human processing. Mozart's music was very, very temporally regulated with long-term repetitions and short-term changes that are very much in the range of normal auditory neural processing. So it's something that can help the brain pick up on harmonic structure, that can help the brain pick up on specific patterns. And the brain loves patterns. Your brain is basically a wet, squishy, pattern-seeking machine. And classical music, such as this Mozart piece, is very good at combining harmonics, which is a regular pattern of acoustic energy over time, along with regular tempos. Both of these are very good for helping the brain set up specific pathways. And every time you hear something, or every time you think, your brain is changing, not just changing what chemicals it's putting out, but will rewire itself. If you hear something that's very familiar, like your name, the first time you hear your name when you were a little kid, it's just sort of like they said blah, blah, blah. But over time, you hear your name a lot, or you'll hear a C major chord a lot because you're being played kids' songs or Christmas music. What this does is your brain actually rewires itself so it becomes easier and easier to pick up these sounds with normal harmonic relationships. So listening to music can have a positive effect on your brain.
Right.
The problem emerged in 1993 when Rauscher, Shaw, and Kai published a neat little study in Nature, which is one of the world's leading scientific journals, which said that if you listen to about 10 minutes of this particular Mozart piece, you saw an increase in a specific part of the Stanford-Binet intelligence test, specifically one having to do with spatial reasoning. Now, that's a lot of words to describe the result, and it was a statistically significant finding. Hello?
Yeah, we still have you. Yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry.
Sorry, I just got a blip on the phone.
Okay, no, we're good. We're good.
Okay. So what happened was you never really get a lot of people willing to read the methodology and the statistical analysis scientific paper, so it got picked up because it was in Nature, a very well-known journal. And suddenly, the findings started getting shortened. And the shortening turned into listening to Mozart makes you smarter. Listening to Mozart will increase your brain power. So clearly, Mozart had some kind of neuroscience secret, and he was the greatest composer ever. These are the kind of things that started appearing in newspapers, magazines, and it just kept snowballing.
Yeah, seeing those headlines.
Yeah, and to the point that the governor of Georgia decided that he was going to put a line item in the budget so that every new mother got a cassette tape of classical music, and for some reason, someone in Texas decided they were only going to play Mozart in prison, but didn't hear about an increase in escape, so I guess it didn't help their spatial reasoning too much. But it finally came to the point that the authors had to write a little letter saying you'd be better off spending the money on musical education than you would by giving all these mothers a classical tape.
So
they had a very specific finding, and it turned into a billion-dollar industry because it had a really snappy little phrase.
So nothing wrong with listening to Mozart, but it's not going to necessarily help you on the Stanford-Binet.
Exactly not. There are a lot of things. Doing almost anything that you enjoy that has regular beat and harmonic content will do the exact same thing, whether it's listening to other music or just listening to your, you know, an audiobook by your favorite author who has a nice, read in a nice sonorous voice. It's just that people keep going back to this one Mozart piece because of how science is done. Scientists like to cite what has been done previously so that they can add an additional citation to whatever they're working on. So you end up people clustering around these particular pieces of music.
Well, let me reintroduce you, and that's Seth Horowitz, our guest today on Radio Times. He's a neuroscientist at Brown University, author of a book called The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. And we have been talking about evolution and the role that hearing has played, I guess, on evolution and vice versa, and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Let me get to Helen from Easton to join us. And Helen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I'm a violin teacher.
Oh.
I teach piano and cello as well. I get so many students who are basically having problems because they've learned to play markings on the fingerboard. And so I'm going to be buying the book because I need all the support I can get.
Okay. And what would you prefer they do, Helen?
They should be learning to play without looking, in other words, not visually, but orally.
Play by ear, yeah.
Play by ear.
Yeah, and most people think that they're going to play by ear by using these sort of artificial frets. And it doesn't really work very well.
Well, that's interesting, Helen. Let me see what Seth Horowitz has to say. Seth, go ahead.
Well, I understand the mechanism for wanting to use these kind of fretboards, and I've seen them, but I have a friend who's also a violin teacher, and she sort of shook her head at them. You can learn the mechanical aspects of playing an instrument, but unless you actually get the feedback from the sound of it to teach you the relationship between moving my finger this way makes this sound, you're learning. It's like you're learning a separate skill, and then they have to learn something else to pair it with the sound. I mean, every instrument except the piano and the keyboard, I learned by picking it up, making horrible sounds and torturing my neighbors for quite a while until it finally evened out, and I learned, moving my fingers this way ties into this kind of sound. Teaching mechanically adds an extra step because you're teaching a motor skill,
right,
and then you're having to teach them the auditory feedback to it.
Helen, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what Gretchen from Wilmington, Delaware has to say. And Gretchen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, yes. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome.
And thanks for doing this show.
You're welcome.
I have a 12-year-old daughter with a moderate to severe hearing loss, which is due to a genetic syndrome, Treacher-Collins syndrome.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
And she uses hearing aids that work through bone conduction, which is completely different from a cochlear implant. But I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about bone conduction, because she cannot locate where sound is coming from.
Yes.
Because of the bone conduction, and it's just amazing to me how she adapts, how she naturally reads lips, and just how she adapts to her world. And she's wonderful and fine. And I'll listen to my comments off the air.
Gretchen, I appreciate the call to Radio Time. Seth Horowitz, go ahead.
What's interesting about bone conduction is it ties together Evelyn Glennie and frogs.
Yes,
we don't just hear it through our ears, even if you don't look at the vibrations that you're picking up through the floor like Evelyn Glennie did. We hear a lot, especially low-frequency sound, via conduction through our bones. And this is something that I learned about studying frogs, because they have very distinctive in-air hearing versus what they get through their belly, their feet, and the side of their bodies. It's not really paid attention to in humans, but what happens is that you basically vibrate a piece of bone in the skull, and it vibrates the ear itself along with it. The limitations she's discussing about being able to pick up where sound is coming from is because you use two different mechanisms for picking up where sound is coming from, whether it's low frequency or high frequency. And if you're presenting sound by vibrating the skull, it can work very well for picking up low-frequency sound, but you lost the differentiation between the two ears because the sound will wrap around your skull. But it is a wonderful technique for people who have partial hearing to gain a lot of it back. You're just basically taking a microphone and using that to shake your head.
And is it true that as you get older, you lose your hearing?
Unfortunately, that's true. As mammals, we have some of the best hearing on the planet. And even if you hear well, your dog hears better than you.
Yes.
You're a mammal. You hear better than 75% of the vertebrates on the planet. And unfortunately, what happens is as we get older, we lose our high-frequency hearing. And we all start off, unless we've had some kind of an accident or pathology or genetic inheritance, we hear up to about 20 kilohertz when we're young. And by the time most people are my age, at 50, you're usually down to about 16,000 hertz, which doesn't interfere too much. But by the time you get up to about 75 or 80, you're beginning to lose your high-end hearing at the top end of the speech harmonic range. It means that you can't identify where sounds are coming from easily. And it also makes you feel like people are muttering, which is why a lot of older people often, especially people who may be showing some Alzheimer's-like symptoms, it may just be the fact that they've lost some of their high-frequency hearing, and it does sound like the world is muttering behind their back because they can't figure out where sound is coming from.
What about all those people, and I was going to say young people, but I think it is largely young people, but all those people that walk around with earbuds in their ears, it's a very common thing to see.
It depends on how neurotic you are about keeping the volumes at appropriate level, and let's face it, younger kids like louder sounds.
Yeah.
Chronic exposure to loud sounds, even if you get used to it and you like it, you find it arousing, it's bad for your ears. It's not going to be the fact that we're going to end up with a deaf population, but we're going to probably see generations of kids from the post-Walkman era who always had music available and not just hanging out on their shoulder in a boombox or transistor radio. We're going to find that if they've been wearing earplugs or earphones over their head for long periods of time, they're going to see a more rapid degradation, particularly of the high-frequency hearing as they get older.
Is that because it's being injured or worn down or why?
There's a lot of reasons why. If we knew the exact reason, we'd probably be able to come up with some kind of treatment. One of the reasons is that the way that your inner ear, the cochlea, is shaped, it's sort of a spiral. And you've got all the hair cells, which are little sensors that vibrate back and forth in the liquid that's in the middle in the inner ear. Well, all the ones that are responsive to high frequency are right close to the part that is nearest the outside world. So they get hammered, even if you're not playing sound, they're still vibrating back and forth. They just won't pick it up. So as with anything, any biological or mechanical system, you get wear and tear. And the thing that sees the most use usually fails first. So the high frequency tends to go first.
Hold on to that thought only because we have to take a very short break. That's Seth Horowitz. He's a neuroscientist and assistant research professor at Brown University, co-founder of something called NeuroPop, the first sound design and consulting firm to use neurosensory and psychophysical algorithms in music. He's also the author of The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
The Wilmington University College of Education supports WHYY and offers a Master of Education program in school leadership. This NCATE-accredited program for aspiring school leaders addresses research, theory, and practice related to effective schools, teaching and learning, and school reform. The program emphasizes translating educational theory into practice. Wilmington University courses begin every 8 weeks at locations throughout the region. More at wilmu.edu/education-degrees.
Lyle Talbot starred with Humphrey Bogart before Bogart was a star. Talbot worked with Mae West and Shirley Temple, was Lex Luthor in Superman serials, co-starred in Ed Wood's film about a transvestite, Glenn or Glenda, and played Ozzy's friend Joe in Ozzy and Harriet. On the next Fresh Air, his daughter Margaret Talbot talks about her new memoir about him. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. We'll have the latest on the situation in the Middle East. Also, it's Thanksgiving, time for turkey and football. We'll have servings of both. Thank you very much. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture, here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Seth Horowitz about some of the findings in his new book called The Universal Sense, How Hearing Shapes the Mind. One open line at 1-888-477-9499. As I was reading your book, I don't know why, I kept hearing the sounds of casinos. So I want to play, which is obviously a completely fabricated soundscape. And of course, at a casino, you're not playing with real money. There's no sense of time. You don't know whether it's day or night. And then casinos have created this kind of ambient sound. Let's listen to this. So that's just the sound of a casino. I think anyone that's been in a casino would recognize that. Seth Horowitz is someone that has looked at some of the psychological uses of sound. What are casino makers, owners doing to their patrons?
Well, it's not just the casinos, but they're following a very basic psychophysical rule, which is that loud sounds are basically bad. It increases your arousal, it gets you revved up, and in natural world, if you're just sitting outside and you hear something loud, what you want to do is move away from it. It could be an earthquake, it could be something coming to eat you, it could be, in a slightly less natural setting, it's a truck coming up on you. So we, at a basic level, we respond to loud as being something big and probably dangerous. But if you go into a place voluntarily that's loud, what you're doing is you're seeking the arousal.
Mm-hmm.
And so at least around here, if you go into the casinos, it's very quiet when you walk in at first. But as soon as you walk into the gaming room, there's this enormous wall of sound. And it's bells and human voices and announcements. And it's very loud, and it gets your blood pumping and gets your heart racing and your blood pressure goes up. It gives you all the symptoms of a fight-or-flight syndrome, but you've elected to be there. So what happens is, even though, like, okay, I'm going to be here and I'm going to gamble something, what the loudness does is it increases any behavior you can do to get control over your environment, because the loud sound seems to be out of your control. And in a loud restaurant, it'll make you drink faster. In a loud bar, same thing. A loud gym, the theory is that it'll make you run faster or work out faster. In a casino, it'll make you gamble faster. But it's not that simple. First of all, some people like myself, going into a loud environment, we'll turn around and walk right out. Mm-hmm. Other people, the context will make a big difference. There was one study which looked at gambling and loud noises, and it found that people who have self-admitted gambling problems found the loud noises aversive because they had associated with losing in the past, whereas people who just didn't have a gambling problem would go in and gamble more because they would associate it with the occasional win. It's related to why me with my 50-year-old ears, I'm not going to go anywhere near an Abercrombie and Fitch store because there's a corporate mandated loudness level between 80 and 90 decibels. But kids who enjoy the arousal and have younger ears than me will go in there and probably spend more money.
Interesting. Let me get some more callers in. It looks like we have Karen from Mount Airy joining us on Radio Times. And Karen, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I was just responding to earlier when you said that about mothers hearing their children's voices and sort of responding to that, and what the effect of being pregnant is on hearing your child's voice. And I sort of bristled, I guess, at that a little bit, because I'm an adoptive mother, and I adopted my son when he was 2, and I'm an incredibly heavy sleeper, but since he's been with me, if he turns over in his sleep or whimpers or anything, my eyes snap open, and I'm immediately awake. so.
Well, don't bristle at that. It was not meant in any kind of a disrespectful
way. Oh, no, no.
Just the simple act of being around kids can trigger hormonal changes and can trigger changes in your behavior. I mean, I just had my 8-month-old godson up here, and I don't have kids of my own, but my wife and I were looking at each other by the end of about 10 days, looking. We're both sitting here on the edge of fight or flight all the time because we know we're listening for the baby, and it's not our kid, but suddenly there's this dependent, noise-making child in the house, and so we're all on alert. So it's not just pregnant mothers. I was just stating that I'd be interested in seeing if there's some biological change that occurs during pregnancy. It would also be just as interesting to look at someone who has adopted a child or suddenly been exposed to them where they don't have children of their own. The thing is that your brain is incredibly plastic and will adapt very rapidly to changes in your environment. The baby became normal because we were hosting my friend and his wife and the baby because of Sandy. You know, their house was in trouble, and so they came up here to be safe. But it changed my brain and my wife's brain as well, not to mention the cat's brain. Was too thrilled with the whole thing.
Karen, thanks for calling into Radio Times. Let's see what Sue from Ardmore has to say. And then I do want to play the title theme of Jaws. But let's hear what Sue is calling about. Sue, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I was wondering if you know of any work being done in the United States on addressing the levels of environmental noise. I think there was a World Health Organization study that came out in 2011 that comes up with levels, safe levels, that are about half of what we currently consider safe in the United States.
Sue, thanks for calling into Radio Time. Seth, go ahead.
Okay, OSHA has a series of regulations and guidelines, but they're specific to the workplace. One difference I noted, because my wife and I have done recording projects in Europe as well as here, is that countries in the EU are much more tuned to acoustic greening, to keeping cities and towns quieter than the United States. And this is obviously true. If you go to New York, your average daily sound, or at least where I used to live in Brooklyn, could be 78 decibels, which is really loud, and according to regulations, I shouldn't be exposed to it more than 8 hours a day, but it was 24 hours a day.
Right.
But the problem is that controlling it is very difficult. It's going to change by the environment. It's going to change by how much traffic there is. A lot of European nations have more public transportation, which reduces road noise, and road noise is a major contributor to environmental sound, especially in cities. One of the things that impressed me when I went to Venice was, even though there were thousands of people in San Marco Plaza, it was quiet. And I was trying to figure out what it was. The buildings are using limestone. Okay, that absorbs sound. And then I realized there were no roads.
Right.
There's no road traffic whatsoever. So all the low-frequency sounds that I always considered normal are gone. So there is a difference based on geographical region. And unfortunately, the U.S. hasn't really taken much of a lead in decreasing sound levels. But I'm hoping that one of the projects from the Just Listen project, which we're tentatively calling Worldwide Ear, where people will be able to record their environment and upload it onto a map, might give people a better handle on how noisy is their normal environment.
Sue, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You have a chapter in your book about movies and music. I love movies, and I'm also much more educated today about the use of sound in movies to enhance the story, to help us understand character. And I do want to play the main title theme of John Williams' legendary score for the original blockbuster Jaws. And it's going to start quietly, but I think you know it's where it's going to go. Let's listen to this, and then, Seth, we can talk afterwards.
Thank you.
there it is, the main title to Jaws, of course, the John Williams legendary score. And Seth Horowitz, my producers and engineer and I were all staring at each other wide-eyed, listening to that music. It's so effective. How come?
It's an amazing, iconic piece.
It is.
And it's one of the few times that tubas really get to be in the forefront. But what was it doing? It was about building tension. And as I said before, loud often signals danger, but so does low pitch. What most people don't know about is the fact that there's a really tight relationship in your brain between the pitch of something, the frequency it puts out, and its size. If a mouse comes up to you and squeaks, it's not too menacing. It's a very high-pitched sound. A baby's cry can be very irritating, very piercing, but it's not really frightening unless they're adding in screaming sounds because something's really wrong. But if you hear that kind of low-pitched womp, 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 that the tuba was doing, it gets right down into your brain stem and says, large, dangerous animal. And if you go into a good theater with a good sound system, which is a proper way to hear that kind of soundtrack, or if you hear it performed live or just get in front of a tuba player, you're not just getting low-frequency, normal-hearing sound. You're also getting those infrasonic vibrations. A tuba can really just make you feel it right in your chest. And those kind of sounds, you don't even have to process it very much. It goes to very baseline levels area of your brain and says, there's something scary coming. And the fact that it's going slowly and occasionally at the beginning and then speeding up and getting louder means whatever this is, it's getting closer. And that was the whole point. And that's why it was just brilliant emotional composition.
This is going to be a very jarring segue, but we're close to the Christmas holidays. And I just want to play a little piece of Frosty the Snowman, because, again, you also write about Christmas music and why these songs have stayed with us. Let's give just a very quick listen.
Frosty the Snowman was a jolly, happy soul. With a corncob pipe and a button nose and two eyes made out of coal.
Frosty the Snowman, it's a fairy tale they say. He was made of snow, but the children know how he came to life one day.
There must have been some magic.
And that's Jimmy Durante's classic take on Frosty the Snowman. That goes back to a 1969 TV special. So why do these Christmas songs, why have they lasted?
Well, they've lasted because they're very harmonic and they're very consonant, which means that all of the notes sound good together. Everything sounds in a major key. If you think about something that's sad music versus happy news, it's the difference between a major key and a minor key, and it has to do with the separation of the notes and the harmonics. Notes that are distributed in a very harmonic fashion that give you, octaves or C major chords are very easy for our brains to cope with. All the sounds are interrelated mathematically. But if you hear set notes that are very close together, they sound jarring, they sound discordant, they sound dissonant. And those feed into a minor key. They add tension, and we tend to associate them with sadness. Well, Christmas carols are almost universally in very consonant, played at very, very regular rates. They're the kind of thing that everybody can sing along to. They evolved from instrument-free carolers on the street. So it was just something that a bunch of amateurs could get around and sing. So they tend to be very sticky. As soon as I heard that, my brain went, oh, no, not this again. It's
I know, sorry about that.
That's okay, because it's going to stick with me all day. I'm very prone to earworms. Right. And so when you have regularly repeating patterns, it's very consonant. It's easy for your brain to lock onto them. And as long as they're played at in a rhythm, that would be easy for your body to tap your fingers to or tap your toes to. They tend to fit into well-worn grooves within your brain, and they can get stuck. Which is why the first time you hear some Christmas music, hopefully after Thanksgiving, but less and less frequently now, you say, oh, okay, it's the beginning of the holiday season. And by the time the holidays actually roll around, you're getting a little bit sick of it. And the day after, it's like, okay, if I never hear that again, as long as I live, I will be a happier person. Because acoustically, familiarity does breed contempt, and you get kind of tired of it. But if you listen to Christmas songs, and almost every major musician has been sucked into doing the mandatory Christmas album, you hear everybody desperately trying to stick to the same pattern. Keep it very consonant, keep it very regular, keep it all major key, and try to come up with something memorable. It's very hard. You remember, there were a couple of classics that you'll remember because you heard it as a kid, but for the most part, the music all sounds the same, so that it gets rapidly old.
Well, we're nearly out of time, and I was hoping to get Erica on, but you can't. But I want to ask her question: why does music memory last longer? Is there a short answer to that question?
Short answer is that music memory is, again, it ties in with how your brain processes familiar information. And if music that you've heard as a child, particularly, you repeat it a lot, it's helped develop the pathways in your brain. It will last with you a lifetime.
Well, on that note, Seth Horowitz, thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And happy Thanksgiving to you.
Happy Thanksgiving to you.
And his book is called The Universal Sense, and it's subtitled How Hearing Shapes the Mind. And he is an assistant research professor at Brown University and a neuroscientist and co-founder of something called NeuroPop. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times to find out more about this program. Let's see, who do we have here engineering today? We have Fred Snyder, our engineer today for Radio Times. We had assistance the last couple of days from Jared Brausch. Susan Greenbaum produces the show along with Patty McMahon, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. And again, happy Thanksgiving from all of us here at WHYY. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Coming up next is